What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In 1985, Bret Easton Ellis, then barely in his 20s and still in college, became the poster boy for 80s-style disaffected youth with his breakout novel Less Than Zero, the bestseller about rich kids on winter break in Los Angeles in a bored delirium of partying, sex, and drugs, sent Ellis to the top of A-list young writers as an instant celebrity. He followed that with The Rules of Attraction, about campus life at its worst in the Reagan years, and then with the 1991 blockbuster American Psycho, about a Wall Street serial killer he said was modeled at heart after his own father. Now, the literary celebrity bad boy is hitting middle age. At 41, Ellis has come out with Lunar Park. It's part fictionalized autobiography, part horror story, and it's a window into Ellis' take on all that's very wrong with suburbia. Kids on meds, demons in the house. This hour, On Point, novelist Bret Easton Ellis on his work, his life, and his new novel, Lunar Park. You can join the conversation. Do you remember the 80s dawn of Bret Easton Ellis and the Brat Pack? Were you a reader of Less Than Zero, of American Psycho? Did the cocaine and bleak sex and self-absorption draw you in or send you running? What's your take on the Bret Easton Ellis story? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Bret Easton Ellis. His new book is Lunar Park. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. So,
thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. You're back on the book tour trail. You've been there before. How is it this time out?
Well, it's actually just starting. I'm doing some dates here in New York right now, and next week I fly out to L.A. And then the tour starts properly after Labor Day. So I really haven't hit it full force yet. But so far, it's been nice. A lot of people at the readings, a lot of goodwill from the audience, at least. readers.
Right.
From the readers and the people who show up, yeah.
And at least a reference right away to some critics who have come at this hammer and tongs. Not all by any means, but the ones who haven't liked Lunar Park have just been brutal about it. The worst they've ever read, just up one side and down the other. What do you make of the ferocity of the critique from those who don't like it?
I don't make anything out of it. I've never really cared particularly what critics say. I do read every review, however, and I am actually interested in what they say, but do I care about it? It depends, I guess, on which critic I'm reading at that time. Part of the reason why I really don't why it really doesn't mean anything in the end is that when you're working on the book, a critical reception has nothing to do with your inspiration,
right,
or why you write a novel. So that's kind of why it's easy to make the disconnect between, you know, the book itself and what reviewers write about the book. But I must admit, there were a couple times so far where I've been disappointed. I like A.O. Scott. He writes for the New York Times, mm-hmm. and I'm in sync with his taste, and by no means a bad review, but it was still mixed, and I wish it was a little bit better.
I'm looking here at The Economist. They say, of course, I mean, one of the things that everyone's talking about in the book is that you make Bret Easton Ellis the protagonist, the main character here. The Economist says the choice to make his main character a carbon copy of himself, we'll talk about that carbon copy business, is by turns vain, lazy, and entertaining. I mean, if you don't care about the critics exactly, you're still reading them. And I wonder how you interpret the message you get from them. I mean, they're looking at the whole arc of your career, the Brat Pack and the bad boy, and, you know, book by book. And here they are in 2005. You're hitting middle age. You come out with this book. And they come out with fangs bared. What's your interpretation? Forget the caring.
What is my interpretation? I don't have one. I'm sorry. I don't have an interpretation of why the critics react to me in the way they do. I simply don't.
Well, then we'll judge for ourselves. Tell us about the new book, Lunar Park. Why did you make Bret Easton Ellis the protagonist, the semi-autobiographical, I guess, central character?
I first conceived of Lunar Park in 1989, so it was a long time ago. And I was also thinking about another book, Glamorama, at the same time. And I didn't feel that I had the chops to pull off Lunar Park because it was about a writer who was older than me. And it was about a strained marriage, and it was about the suburbs. And I thought, well, this other book about a young male model and the celebrity scene in New York, I think I can handle that at however old I was.
That's Glamorama came out in 98. Mm-hmm.
Right, 98. Mm-hmm. And so then during that time, I worked on a fairly long, detailed outline of Lunar Park. And the protagonist was fictional. It wasn't me. But there were a lot of elements to his personality that was based on my life and my career. And so by the time I sat down to write Lunar Park in the summer of 2000, I suddenly got stuck. And I was sitting there thinking, why am I stuck? Why can't I get on with this? And I realized it was maybe it had something to do with the fact that this guy was so similar to me by this point. Why not just name him me? Why not go all the way and just make him Bret Easton Ellis? I mean, there's enough things in it that it's so autobiographical anyway. Mm. And so that's what happened. It was kind of a technical problem in terms of solving a block I was in and just making this fictional writer me. And that's how that happened.
You end up with a story that sounds very close to your story at the beginning. College student, writes a novel for a course, turns into quite a bestseller, and he's out of the gates with all the celebrity right from the beginning, the Brat Pack reputation and all the rest. But by the time we really get into Lunar Park, the Bret Easton Ellis we find here seems to be looking for some kind of redemption or exorcism, because there's a huge horror story element here, from the very body of work that he's produced himself. How did you foresee that in 1989? You were still pretty early on in your curve.
I didn't in 1989. In 1989, I wanted to write a genre book. I wanted to write an homage to Stephen King and to the horror comics that I loved as a boy and as an adolescent, and to all the kind of, trashy supernatural thrillers that I responded to and felt very nostalgic about. So that's really what the impetus came from. And then as the outline grew over those 10 years, a lot of stuff happened to me. One of them was the publication of American Psycho and my dismay and shock that Patrick Bateman was going to define me, basically.
The serial killer, the man who was so violent that Simon & Schuster wouldn't bring it out. You had to find a different publisher.
Exactly. And that book would become pretty much the book that was going to define my career and who I was for a long time, if not forever. And that Patrick Bateman was going to become this hugely iconic figure, something that I had not prepared or planned for or even thought about when I was writing the book, because I thought he was just a pretty faceless guy. I thought the book was more about New York in that moment rather than about this guy, Patrick Bateman.
And it turns out the face pasted on there was yours. We'll have a lot of listeners who have read it, but some who haven't. Describe Patrick Bateman in American Psycho and why you were not eager to have that become your face.
Well, Patrick Bateman is a young guy who works on Wall Street. The book roughly covers 1987, 1988. And he's obsessed with all the trappings of that lifestyle and status and money. And he also happens to be a serial killer. And the book is follows him for a couple of years, kind of aimless days at the office and dinners and restaurants and his girlfriends, et cetera, et cetera. But it also interspersed throughout the text are extremely violent passages because he's also a serial killer. So this character became very famous and began to haunt me. And while I was working on the outline for Lunar Park, the idea of a writer creating something that was going to ultimately overwhelm him and define him became very, very intriguing to me. And that became an element in Lunar Park, as did the death of my father in 1992. We had a very unresolved relationship. He died very unexpectedly. And so the idea of the ghost of the father haunting the narrator in Lunar Park became a big, big deal. And ultimately, it was also, by the time I was ready to write the actual book, I was interested in the idea of what does it mean to be a fiction writer? What does it mean to sit in a room all day and create fiction? And that also became part of the texture of this novel.
So, in a sense, you've got the homage to Stephen King here, you've got the horror story, but you were, in fact, yourself looking for a kind of exorcism of Patrick Bateman, a character you'd created.
Well, yeah, Patrick Bateman to a degree. I mean, that's part of the whole, I guess, supernatural element. I like the idea of an author creating a Frankenstein-like figure that gets out of control and actually leaves a fiction that the author created and then is allowed to roam free. I thought that's a very interesting metaphor, and also behave as badly as he does within the book that he was created for.
A.O. Scott, you mentioned him, says, it's the portrait of a narcissist who is, in the end, terminally bored with himself. Has it got you there?
No, I'm not bored with myself. And I don't know how narcissistic I am. I mean, I suppose if any artist is a narcissist, I mean, and I suppose if you're, writing a novel and there are large elements of it that are taken from your life, yeah, I guess narcissism rap can apply, but lazy. Well, actually, that might apply too. You know what? A.O. Scott might be completely right in his review. I have to reevaluate this now. I mean, I blanched when I read that, but hey, maybe he's onto something. I don't know.
Well, there's no question it's entertaining, and we're reading that as well. But here we got Bret Easton Ellis taking his lumps as he comes out with Lunar Park. They sell even as he takes his lumps. Janice Nomura, Los Angeles Times, trusting readers may accept this public therapy session as sincere, but it feels more like another chapter in the book of Ellis' egomania. What do you think? Have you been reading Bret Easton Ellis since Less Than Zero, since American Psycho? You can join the conversation this morning. Do you remember the 80s dawn of this writer and the Brat Pack he was part of? Did the cocaine and orgies and murder and self-absorption draw you in or send you running? Is there redemption in the Bret Easton Ellis world, or just numbness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bret, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Bret Easton Ellis. His new novel is Lunar Park. You may know him from Less Than Zero, from American Psycho. You can join the conversation. Are you a Bret Easton Ellis fan? What keeps you reading? Are your suburbs the neighborhood of horrors that Ellis describes in his, in Lunar Park? Can a novelist exorcise past demons by writing himself into a novel? Or are the demons what you want from Bret Easton Ellis? A lot of his books have been turned into films. American Psycho, 1991 book, 2000 movie. Here's just to give you a flavor of how it's gone through the Hollywood prism is sound from the trailer of the 2000 movie, which starred Christian Bale as serial killer Patrick Bateman.
When I see a pretty girl walking down the street, I think two things. One part of me wants to be real nice and sweet and treat her right.
And what'd the other part think?
What her head would look like on a stick.
I feel lethal, on the verge of frenzy. Something horrible is happening. I think my mask of sanity is about to slip.
You're inhuman.
No, I'm in touch with humanity.
I have all the characteristics of a human being, but not a single clear, identifiable emotion. I simply am not there.
The trailer from the 2000 movie American Psycho, based, of course, on Bret Easton Ellis's 1991 novel American Psycho. Mr. Ellis, you have said that Patrick Bateman, who we hear they're saying, I feel lethal on the verge of frenzy, that at heart this is your father you were portraying here. What do you mean by that?
Well, Patrick Bateman was based on a couple of people. I mean, he was based on my dad, and I was influenced by my father's behavior in a way. And that was another thing that I wanted to exercise, I guess, because I saw myself living a kind of lifestyle at that time in Manhattan that you know, to a degree, mimic Patrick Bateman's. I mean, let's cut out the murder and the torture and everything. But on another level, as a young man living in that city during that period, the novel is pretty autobiographical. So it was part my dad, part me, and it was partly fictitious. But when I reread American Psycho recently, I had to because there were things in it that had to match up with what's going on in Lunar Park.
Right.
I was surprised how much I agreed with Patrick Bateman about a lot of stuff, and I found him a very compelling character. And I agreed with a lot of his criticism, the implied criticism in his monologue about society, and I thought his misery was justified in the end, which I didn't expect, and I really wasn't thinking that much about when I was writing it when I was 23, 24, 25. So that changed.
Now you've taken us out of that very urban Manhattan scene and into the burbs in Lunar Park. Lunar Park. A destination, an address in the suburbs of the new book. And it's a pretty grim place. You're an L.A. kid. You've written about that life before. What's the picture of American suburbs today that you're giving us here?
Well, you know, I don't want to harp too much on the fact that Lunar Park takes place in the suburbs. I mean, it actually takes place in a fictional suburb. I mean, the author of the book won't tell exactly where these horrible events took place. It's a vague place. I think he calls Midland County. But my main goal when I was working on Lunar Park was to write a genre book about a haunted house and the characters in it and why was it haunted. And it was ultimately to deal with some issues about my dad, and it was also to deal with what it means to be a writer. The suburbs just happened to be the setting for this book, and it just seemed that it wasn't going to be able to, at least in my mind, take place anywhere else.
But you've got all the kids on Ritalin. You've got security cameras following them from the carpool car door to the school door. I mean, if I recall, even the dog is on Prozac. It's a pretty bunkered place. This Midland America.
Yeah, but it's also my take on parenting and what's going on in the culture. I mean, look, I don't have kids and I'm not married, but I have plenty of friends who are, and I see how they raise them. And I'm not saying that they raise them badly at all, but still there is,
really?
For the most part. If you're a fiction writer and you're writing about contemporary society and the world today, you know, you pay attention to stuff. You read a lot of stuff, and when it comes time to write a scene in a novel, you the way you look at the world and the way you experience it, you're able to just pull stuff out and lay it within the text that you're working on. So I did not set out to write a satirical take on the suburbs. I just wrote what I thought was an honest portrayal of what I think is going on. And, of course, it's filtered through the Bret Easton Ellis prism. So it is probably a little grimmer and a little darker than it might actually be.
That prism seems to spot depravity very quickly and pull it front and center. Why?
You asked that with a very special urgency. I don't know.
It's a hallmark of almost every book at one level.
Yeah, I guess to a degree it's been something that I've been attracted to. I think so. I think less so with this book, but certainly in the other books, I think because of what the books were about, I don't think I'm a person who's particularly drawn toward depravity in my quote unquote everyday existence by any means. But as a fiction writer, yeah, I've been drawn to characters who are somewhat depraved. Why? I don't know. I guess as a satirist, when I was writing satirical novels like American Psycho or Glamorama, because of what it means to be a satirist and why and how you look at the world, in the satirical way, that lends itself to exploring, certain kinds of depravity. That could be a reason. But
do you think the United States is a depraved culture today?
Oh, I mean, I guess you go into any culture, I guess, and, find depravity in it. Sure, on a certain level, yeah, it is. That sounds very noncommittal, doesn't it?
Well, I didn't expect anything less. I want to begin to bring our callers in, if I may. We're talking with novelist Bret Easton Ellis. His new novel is Lunar Park. Ron is calling from Boston. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hi. Mr. Ellis, it's very nice to be able to speak to you. My question to you is, American Psycho, what was your reason for choosing to put so much graphic violence into that book? And how do you feel about how it affected your work after that?
Ron, let me ask you, were you already reading Bret Easton Ellis when American Psycho came out? Had you read his earlier?
Yeah, I had read, I mean, Lesson Zero, to me, is just an amazing book as Catcher in the Rye or The Great Gatsby.
This is the kids in L.A. partying down over Christmas vacation. I mean, what about The Rules of Attraction?
Really, really capturing the... the sort of flavor of people my age. I'm 41, as is the author.
Mm-hmm.
Rules of Attraction, I enjoyed it. It was a little bit different. The setting was different.
Kind of setup of Bennington College, a send-up where Bret Easton Ellis attended in Vermont, right?
Right. American Psycho, I must admit, I had a very hard time getting through. I completed the book, but I was shocked at the amount of violence, and I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Bret Easton Ellis?
When I reread the book in the summer of 2003, that same summer that I found it fast and funny and Patrick Bateman quite compelling, I was also very dismayed by how I reacted to the violence. It was shocking, and it was extremely upsetting to read. I hadn't read the book since its publication, and I was expected to be bothered by other things. I thought it was going to be, like, pretentious, and I thought all the things that I was interested in when I was in my early 20s were going to stick out like a sore thumb, all my conceptual tropes, et cetera, et cetera. But no, none of that. Patrick Bateman's voice really just takes over. But, however, when I came to the violent sequences, I had to steel myself. And I now understand how the violence in that book could have distracted people from whatever the book's overall message was, or not its message, but its overall meaning. It distorts it to a degree. Would I change it now? No. I mean, it's the book that I wanted to write at that time. But does the violence bother me now at 41 in a way that it didn't when I was in my early 20s? Definitely.
Ron, are you still reading, or did it scare you right off the reservation?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I intend to read the next book, absolutely. I think you're an amazing writer, and it's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Ron, thanks a lot for your call. So there's American Psycho violence, and here you've got Stephen King-style horror. Without giving it all away, give us a flavor of just how horror genre you go in Lunar Park.
It doesn't really go that far. I mean, the ghost story at the heart of the book really is about a father warning a son, which is the narrator of the novel, about something terrible happening. And so the book is really full of a lot of portents of doom. But in terms of actual violence, I think there's maybe a couple of descriptive passages because there is a person going around the countryside that the author has moved to who's committing the murders from American Psycho in sequence. There's a line or two that refers to that. But overall, it really is a ghost story. It's about a haunted house, and it's not about violence. A couple of gruesome scenes, I suppose, but they involve, monsters and ghouls.
But you've got real demons here, though. I mean, this is King-style toys beginning to talk and weird things popping out of weird places.
It is. In a way, I wish that it had stayed as pure as I wanted it to have been in 1989, just do a straight-ahead haunted house book, and maybe, I don't know, maybe that would have worked better with the critics, at least, instead of me making it a much more autobiographical piece of fiction.
You've been praised for the final pages here in particular, where you've got a kind of elegiac coming to terms, I wonder if you'd call it that, with your father. What was at the heart of your problem with your dad?
I think the problem was that he didn't really want to be married, and I don't think he really wanted to have kids. I think that he followed the conformist route of the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, and instead of becoming a playboy and staying single, You know, I got married really early, had three kids, moved to the suburbs of Los Angeles, got a job that I don't know if he was so happy in. And I think this made him angry. And I don't think he was his life did not end up being what he wanted it to be. And he became an alcoholic, and he was very abusive and a very, very unhappy man. And by the time he died, we were no longer speaking. He had gotten really out of control. After his death, however, there were a lot of things I regretted, a lot of things that I wanted resolved, and a lot of things I wanted to say to him. And I think that by the end of Lunar Park, I have to say it was therapy in a way writing this book, and some demons were exorcised. And especially when I was writing those last pages about him and our past and the spreading of his ashes.
Finally getting them where he wanted them to go.
Yeah, I felt something lift off me. I really did. All the therapy in the world during those years didn't help, but I guess being a creative writer, that's how I work out my stuff. I mean, that's how I deal with things. I deal with them in my fiction.
I have to say it was ghoulishly or wonderfully funny, depending how you look at it. The father in the book wants his ashes spread at sea. Instead, the protagonist, named Bret Easton Ellis, is feeling guilty because the ashes are sitting in the Bank of America.
Well, they were kept. I got to be honest with you. My father's ashes were kept for many years in a safe deposit box in a Bank of America in Sherman Oaks. And my sisters and I had a lot of issues and a lot of arguments about what to do with them. So, and they were not spread actually until after I completed Lunar Park. They were not spread until sometime earlier this year, in fact.
I'd like to talk with you for a minute, if we may, about your reputation as a generation writer. I mean, you know, you've got your boomers and Gen X and Gen Y and whatever's coming next. Here you come in the middle of the 80s, very young, and a big glittering splash right away, integral to this Brat Pack with Jay McInerney and more. How do you think – I know this is in no small part a media creation, but yet you've carried it around this reputation as a generational writer. What generation was that?
I don't know. I never saw myself as one. I never saw myself as a generational writer. I saw myself as someone who was simply writing about topics that were of interest to me and keeping tabs on people I knew and our behavior. To other people, yeah, you can call me a generational writer, but there were a lot of other things going on in the books that I was concerned with. I was concerned with language. I was concerned with style. I was concerned with presentation. Sure, the books were – but the books are about people my age. Each book is about a person who's roughly my age, from Lesson Zero, which I wrote in my – late teens, on to, you know, Lunar Park, where most of the cast is my age, is 41 and middle-aged.
But you did come up out of those Reagan years. I mean, we all have the imprint of the years of our youths. What do you think is the Reagan decade imprint on Bret Easton Ellis?
Well, I'd like to think that there was none, but
we're not going to buy that. I mean, we all grow up in a time.
Yeah, but for some reason, I don't really feel like the 80s defined me. I mean, I suppose that other people felt that the 80s defined me. And because many of my books were set in the 80s, I suppose that's why I was known as an 80s writer. Or to some people, it still am considered an 80s writer. But that's only because I was writing those books during that time. And I was writing about contemporary society. So I don't know. I don't see myself as a generational writer.
I was thinking it was definitely a time when celebrity became huge in America. You became known as a celebrity novelist, in part because of your age and the Brat Pack reputation. Does that still sit float around your shoulders in a way that's comfortable or awkward or just a fact of life?
Not something I really think about too much. No. No, it's not a part of my life. I don't necessarily feel like a celebrity writer, whatever that might mean.
Pretty well in Lunar Park through the semi-fictional Bret Easton Ellis.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, this, again, here we get into this whole Hall of Mirrors thing. I mean, that is fiction. And the opening 40 pages or so, this mock autobiography, of course, is exaggerated, you know, and for dramatic effect. But I never really felt it. I never really felt that I was a member of a Brat Pack. I never really felt that I was a literary celebrity. I've always felt, and I've never felt like a part of a group of writers either.
The mounds of cocaine, the bored sex. That's not that's certainly the reputation that traveled with you.
I don't necessarily see that in the later books. I don't really see the bored sex so much in the later books. There might have been a sort of like sadness about the sex and an ennui about it in the earlier books, but it's not there in the later books. I guess maybe more desperation in the later books.
We're going to take a short break here. We're talking this hour with novelist Bret Easton Ellis about his work, his life, and his new novel, Lunar Park. You can join the conversation. Are you a Bret Easton Ellis fan, a reader? What keeps you coming back? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Bret Easton Ellis about his work, his life, and his new novel, Lunar Park. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Are you still following the writer of American Psycho and more? Tony's calling from Boston. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. What do you think?
I've only read American Psycho, and I was very taken by it. I liked it a lot. One of the things that really stuck with me about it, though, is about halfway through the book, you kind of start wanting Patrick Bateman to commit violence because the rest of his life is so trite and so, you know, so, like, self-absorbed that the only part that even seems human is, like, his murderous side.
He's only alive when he's cutting people up for you.
Yeah, pretty much, because the rest of his day, I mean, he does a boring job. You never actually really even find out about it in detail because it's just covered with, like, you know, appointments with people who he forgets the name of right after he meets them.
So where are you going with this, Tony? Did you get an itch to, I don't know, to find a machete?
Well, was it a coincidental thing that that's what it was? Was that, like, planned for that to happen, or was it just kind of a, you know, was it intentional for that, or?
Bret Easton Ellis?
When I was doing some basic research on Wall Street guys in the summer of 86, I expected a different book, but after hanging out with them and asking them what they do and what's going on in their business and how are you young guys making so much money at such an early age, which was really going to be what this novel was about, all they seemed to want to talk about was all the things that the money bought them and the status it brought them and the restaurant reservations and the suits they wore and their hot girlfriends. And for some reason, while I was sitting in one of these dinners, it clicked that one of them would be a serial killer. And I don't know why. It was just one of those moments. And I do think that the triteness of his life and the shallowness of it, that is a lead up to the violence, is a way for him to express himself. But the other question is, do these violent acts actually happen, or are they in his imagination, or are they part of his fantasy life?
Tony, did you find it cathartic, exciting, or it's as you say, the only thing you wanted to read?
Well, I mean, it was just like you what he did every day was pretty much the same exact thing over and over again, but, you know, a different manifestation, different people, everybody's generic, but, you know, these trysts that we'd have with these people and, like, just, like, killing people was just kind of just the more human side of it. That's where the book actually was interesting, you know?
Well, it made a big reputation, one that Bret Easton Ellis exercises a little bit in Lunar Park. Tony, thanks for your call. Let's get another call here. Richard is calling from Florence, North Carolina. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi, Ms. Ellis. Thanks for taking my call. And I want to say thank you very much for Lesson Zero. It was a fantastic book. And American Psycho, I read actually when I was in high school. And I wanted to ask you something. About a month and a half ago, I was in Wales, and I came across a book at a used bookshop, and it was written by a literary critic by the name of Elizabeth Young. Are you familiar with her?
I am. The book's called Shopping in Space. It's an excellent...
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I mean, it's an excellent book about the fiction of that era, and it concentrates mainly on American Psycho, and its interpretation of it is really quite amazing.
Richard, what did you read there, Richard?
I was going to ask you. I mean, does it really make a difference? I mean, when I read this in high school, I'll never forget, I told my high school English teacher, I said, this is not really happening. It can't be happening. I mean, I think this is just he's living vicariously through his fantasies, and I don't think that... You know, this violence is people are just misreading it and they're not understanding the genius behind this metaphor.
What was the interpretation that you read in Shopping in Space, Richard?
Oh, no, actually, it was called Pandora's Bag, I think, or something like that. But what she said, Elizabeth Young, the late Elizabeth Young, she said that as far as she's concerned, nobody understood the real meaning behind American Psycho. No one really understood Patrick Bateman's angst and the fact that he didn't commit any of these violences, that they were so horrendous and outrageous and outlandish that it's just fantasy, and that people totally missed the point and totally missed Mr. Ellis's point on that. And the fact that a lot of these so-called yuppies probably live frustrated lives and probably walking around like thinking like this 24/7.
I hope not. But let's pick it up. Brett, did Ms. Young get you right?
I'm not going to say whether she got me right or she got me wrong. I mean, I think what the book, I always left it open. When I wrote the book, I left it open to interpretation. You could read it either way. You could read it that he does commit these crimes and gets away with them because the society he's a part of doesn't care and is obsessed with other things. Or you could read it as the actual, you know, journals of a madman, of an actual serial killer. And I think that's interesting. I don't think it's interesting for me to clarify anything or go either way. I think it makes the book more mysterious.
I wonder, in the new book, Lunar Park, you've got a similar kind of ambiguity, but this time it's about yourself. What's true? What's not true? What's fiction? What's autobiographical here? Why do you use that? What's the utility of that ambiguity that's kind of something beyond the book itself, if you know what I mean? It's not really in the text. It has to do with you.
Well, I don't know. I guess, I mean, well, people are ambiguous. I mean, aren't they? I mean, people are, we're really never sure about anyone. You always find out secrets about people and people, and certainly that's mirrored in my fiction. I mean, no one is clear cut. People are capable of, you know, great acts of kindness and great acts of brutality. Their sexuality is extremely fluid, et cetera, et cetera. But this is how I don't know. This is how, as a writer, I see the world.
Who do you read now, Bret Easton Ellis? Who do you like? We've now talked about generational writers. We've got more generations since your early splash there. Who's on your nightstand?
Joan Didion.
Why?
Joan Didion's on my nightstand. Yep. Don DeLillo, Philip Roth. I mean, I respond to... I mean, certainly there are members of my generation who have written books that I've liked. But I tend to go – I like older writers right now and writers that were published not in – you know, didn't start getting published in 1980 but were published, I guess, starting in the 60s.
And what about the younger crew? I mean, you've got Jonathan Safran Foer who, like you, has mixed autobiography and fiction.
Jonathan Franzen,
spoken well of.
Jonathan Safran Foer's last book, the one about 9/11, I thought was excellent and rather underrated by the American press. I think Jonathan Franzen wrote the great novel of my generation, The Corrections. I think he did something that every male writer of my generation wanted to do, which was fuse the sensibility of the writer we almost admired, Don DeLillo, with a certain kind of emotional undertow that was missing maybe from DeLillo's work. And created something that I think we all aspire to. So I think that is a great book. And, you know, I mean, there are plenty of others. I like Jonathan Latham a lot, for example. Mm-hmm. And I like the humorous Jonathan Ames. I think he's quite good, too.
Did you see a permission of a kind in Philip Roth to bring yourself half into the book?
Well, Philip Roth, I was reading at the time I was writing Lunar Park. I think I've now read everything by Philip Roth, but I had a mission to read all of Philip Roth, and I was obsessed with him during the last 6 or 7 years. And that definitely became a stylistic influence on some of the longer, more self-criticizing paragraphs in the book where the writer's examining his life and what he does. Definitely came from Roth, who was a very big influence on the first half, at least, of Lunar Park.
Lunar Park is dedicated to two men. Your father, who, as you say, died while this book was in its long gestation, and Michael Wade Kaplan, who you've described as your lover for half a dozen years. Is there an imprint from that death in this book as well?
Well, his death was also very unexpected. He died in January of 04, just as I was about to go into the final rewrite of Lunar Park. And after sort of like dealing with that for about a month, locking myself away, I don't know, the whole thing came into play, you know, the fragility of life, the precariousness of everything. And it was, you know, I had to get up and do something. I had to get up and finish this book. And so his spirit was really hovering over me. And I think it added a layer of wistfulness to the novel that it might have previously been missing.
Wistfulness here, a lot of glitz and glamour in earlier novels. I mean, Glamorama, right in the title. You quote in the front piece here Thomas McGuane from his book Panama, saying, "The occupational hazard of making a spectacle of yourself over the long haul is that at some point you buy a ticket too." Is that what you're doing here?
Yes, it is. It's exactly what I'm doing, you know. I mean, I guess, you know, making a spectacle of myself, I don't know if I necessarily made a spectacle of myself or if the press or if I allowed the press to make a spectacle of myself. I'm sure we were in collusion somehow. And, I'm very amused by the Bret Easton Ellis that appears in the press and the myth of Bret Easton Ellis. It doesn't really correspond to me or my daily life, but it's funny.
Is there a hazard in it? Has there been an occupational hazard for you in it?
Well, I think there is a hazard in it in that takes over. I mean, that Bret sort of is the one that everyone knows. I mean, you can't meet every fan. You can't meet everyone who's reading your books and tell them, look, I know what you've read about me. I know how I'm perceived in every article and how I'm even photographed at times to look more menacing and sinister, et cetera, more like a bad boy. But in the end, no, that Bret is the one that most people know. They don't know. "Quote unquote," the real Bret.
Well, and this time you step up with this homage to Stephen King and horror, wrapped around that bit of autobiography as well. Gets into real new territory. The Economist goes out saying, stylistically, Mr. Ellis is a fine writer, and at his best when he uses a scalpel on other people rather than a butter knife on himself. Sounds like you're moving in that direction.
Well, definitely this book represents the end of something and probably because of that, the beginning of something else. I mean, I know I'm not interested in writing the books that I was interested in writing in my youth. I can't imagine writing American Psycho right now at this point in my life or Glamorama. I think it is heading in another direction. And I think that's just involuntary. I think that just happens with age. There are other things I want to pursue. I don't want to really go around telling people how messed up the world is anymore. I'm more interested in characters and stories and seeing where that takes me rather than, you know, concepts, conceptual fiction, etc.
The author moving on. Bret Easton Ellis, the new book is Lunar Park. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Bret Easton Ellis with Lunar Park. Bret Easton Ellis shot to fame writing about self-absorbed American teen life in the suburbs in the 1980s. He was hardly the first American writer to turn his pen on the burbs. In the 1940s and 50s, John Cheever set classic stories in the New York suburb of Shady Hill. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins me now to share some of his favorite Cheever moments. Jack, thanks for coming in from the exurbs.
Yes, I live in the exurbs. Well, you know, John Cheever really was the premier short story writer of the post-war era. And all of his work really is a defense against this charge that he has an adolescent bring in Bullitt Park, a charge about the sterility of the suburbs. Oh, damn them all, thought the adolescent. Damn the bright lights by which no one reads. Damn the continuous music which no one hears. Damn the grand pianos that no one can play. Damn the white houses mortgaged up to their rain gutters. Damn them for plundering the ocean for fish to feed the mink whose skins they wear. And damn themselves on their shelves. On which there rests a single book, a copy of the telephone directory, bound in pink brocade. Damn their hypocrisy. Damn their cant. Damn their credit cards. Damn their discounting the wilderness of the human spirit. Damn their immaculateness. Damn their lechery. And damn them, above all, for having leached from life that strength, malodorousness, color, and zeal that give it meaning.
Jack Beatty reading from John Cheever's Bullitt Park. And yet, at this point, Jack, Americans live overwhelmingly in the suburbs. Do you feel that same angst out there? Is it just the world as most Americans know it?
It is the world as most Americans know it. From the 1990 census, we are officially a majority suburban nation. It reverses the 1920 census, where we were an urban nation. So, yes, that is the... But, you know, we all have the trope of the sterile suburb, but Cheever's work is to show that the quotidian surface is irradiated with wonder and with epiphanies of happiness. Here from the housebreaker of Shady Hill.
Yes, please.
My name is Johnny Hake. I'm 36 years old, stand 5 feet 11 in my socks, weigh 142 pounds stripped, and am, so to speak, naked at the moment and talking into the dark. I was conceived in the Hotel St. Regis, born in the Presbyterian Hospital, raised on Sutton Place, christened and confirmed in St. Bartholomew's, and I drilled with the Knickerbocker Grays, played football and baseball in Central Park, learned to chin myself on the framework of East Side apartment house canopies, and met my wife at one of the big cotillions at the White House, stayed 4 years at the Waldorf, stayed 4 years in the Navy, have 4 kids now, and live in a banlieue called Shady Hill. We have a nice house with a garden and a place outside for cooking meat, and on summer nights, sitting there with the kids and looking into the front of Christina's dress as she bends over to salt the steaks, or just gazing at the lights in heaven, I am as thrilled as I am thrilled by more hardy and dangerous pursuits. And I guess this is what is meant by the pain and sweetness of life.
So is it paradise or purgatory?
A little of both. And the real world occasionally enters, but always in Cheever, with a sort of askew of wit or satire or magic. The Pastern's bomb shelter had been completed that spring. They would have liked to keep it a secret, would have liked at least to soft-pedal its existence, but the trucks and bulldozers going in and out of their driveway had informed everyone. It had cost $32,000, and it had 2 chemical toilets, an oxygen supply, and a library compiled by a Columbia professor consisting of books meant to inspire hopefulness, humor, and tranquility. There were stores of survival food to last 3 months and several cases of hard liquor. Mrs. Pastern had brought the Pastor of Paris ducks, the birdbath, and the gnomes in an attempt to give the lump in her garden a look of innocence to make it acceptable, at least to herself. For, bulking as it did in so pretty and domestic a scene, and signifying as it must the death of at least half the world's population, she had found it, with its grassy cover, impossible to reconcile with the blue skies and the white clouds. She liked to keep the curtains drawn at that side of the house, and they were drawn the next afternoon when she served gin to the bishop.
John Cheever, read by Jack Beatty. Jack, it's great to have you stop by with your book bag. Thanks for coming
okay,
in.
Okay, pleasure.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Mike Toda, John Berger, and Angel Cozzelli, our senior producer is Joe O'Connor, news analyst Jack Beatty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.